This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, January 20th, the day the nation honors the birthday of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a drum major for peace. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This past Sunday, the three highest-ranking members of the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, and Colin Powell, all made the rounds of the network TV news shows announcing an apparently softer stance on Iraq. War rhetoric was momentarily diminished with the administration proposing that Saddam Hussein go into exile, signaling, according to the Washington Post, that a bargain might be in the offing. Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld said that some provision could be made so that senior leadership in Iraq could be provided haven in some other country. He added that the decision on Iraq would have to be made in a matter of weeks, not months or years. And all three officials, in careful coordination, termed the option of Hussein's exile as extremely remote. With the tremendous anti-war gatherings in Washington and San Francisco over the weekend and Europe-wide protests against a possible war in Iraq slated for mid-February, opposition is mounting to the Bush administration's plan for Iraq. Saturday, a Time CNN poll indicated that President Bush's approval rating is at its lowest, 53%, since September 11th. The talk of exile for Hussein should not obscure the fact that U.S. Special Operations Forces have moved into Iraq's deserts and outside its major cities for an assassination attempt. USA Today reported this morning on a heavy buildup since September in intelligence gathering, including 100 U.S. Special Operations Forces and more than 60 CIA operatives already in place within the country. Assassination of any sovereign leader is in violation of international law. According to international law, a nation has only a very limited right to assassinate a leader and clearly states that only if all other options to restore human dignity had been exhausted would it be permissible. It can't be missed that the talk of exile for Saddam Hussein comes on the heels of one of the largest anti-war protests in Washington since the Vietnam War. It's estimated that between 2 to 500,000 protesters rallied this weekend on the Mall in Washington, D.C., while President Bush retired to Camp David. Speaker after speaker took to the podium in temperatures hovering in the teens, hoping to make the case for peace and insisting the president has not yet made his case for war. Former U.S. Congresswoman from Georgia, Cynthia McKinney, addressed the throng.
We are gathered here today on this cold D.C. day to prevent a war in the hot sands of Iraq. In the bitter coldness of apartheid Cape Town, Bobby Kennedy spoke words of hope to black and white South Africans, encouraging them to stand for their ideals, act to help others, strike out against injustice, and sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression. Yet in 1966, no one could foresee that Nelson Mandela, then apartheid's political prisoner, would be sworn in as South Africa's president, and yet he was. Dr. King warned us that we have guided missiles and misguided men. When Dr. King decided to speak out against an evil and unjust war, even though he knew the consequences might be death, he decided that he had no choice but to speak out against the war in Vietnam. Knowing the consequences, Dr. King did his part. And that's why we're here today. Even though this movement doesn't start with us, each one of us will do our part. For justice, for peace, at home and abroad. And in our quest for justice at home, Mr. President, we won't forget that your brother trampled on the voting rights of the poor and of people of color. You are in the White House and you have a privilege that you didn't earn. Mr. President, where is your mandate to take this country off to war? It was cold last night, Mr. President, and all across our country, it was especially cold for the 250,000 veterans who sleep on our street every night. In no other rich democracy on this planet do so many people have so little. Yet the proposed stimulus package will give billions more to the wealthy. What about us, Mr. President? What about us? On this Dr. King weekend, let us remember that there was a time when the United States was loved around the world. Loved because, like our fallen martyrs, when America saw wrong, we tried to right it. When we saw suffering, we tried to heal it. And when there was war, we tried to stop it. The work that we do today is noble and good. The work for justice, for peace, at home and abroad.
Former U.S. Representative Cynthia McKinney. Presidential candidate and longtime civil rights activist Al Sharpton recalled the aspects of King's teachings that spoke directly to the issues of war and peace.
We come today on the birthday weekend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King started his fight against segregation, but he didn't end there. He fought for world peace. He fought for the fair distribution of wealth. He fought for blood to have more importance than oil. He fought for justice all over the world. That is why, even though he taught the world that America was not for whites only, Dr. King is not for blacks only. Dr. King is for those that love peace, and those in the King tradition is here today. Mr. Bush hung Dr. King's picture up in the White House last year. But he needs to hang up Dr. King's words. Don't have a photo without the words of the one that is in the photo. Hang up the speech Dr. King made at Riverside Church, where he said that we cannot be purveyors of violence, where we cannot put world business interests over the interests of people. If Dr. King was here to celebrate his birthday, Mr. Bush, he would not be inside preparing for military buildup. He'd be outside saying, give peace a chance. In Iraq today, there are weapons inspectors. But here on the west side of the Capitol are the moral inspectors. We're inspecting an immoral policy that says, though we can't find the weapons in Iraq, we want to go to war. We know there's weapons in Korea. We know they lied. But we can talk there, but we got to fight in Iraq. Are we talking about weapons of mass destruction? Or are we talking about a political game of mass distraction? Dr. King challenged that the money in Vietnam could be used here to build housing for the homeless and to care for children. We argue that you say you have no money for state deficits. You have no money for child care. You have no money for our uninsured grandmothers. But you have $100 billion to $1 trillion to go to Iraq about weapons that you can't find. We can't back up. You won't fight in our name. So as I leave you, I wish you a happy King Day. Happy birthday, Martin. We haven't dropped the banner. Happy birthday, Martin. We're going to still stand for peace. Happy birthday, Martin. Just like Bush's son is in the White House, your children is in Washington today. We will stand up. We will not back down. We will fight the fight.
The Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network, and a man who has stood firm in the fight for civil rights for several decades. The legacy of Dr. King, as defined by the mainstream media, has long emphasized his self-appointed title as a drum major for peace. But those who had the opportunity to meet Dr. King speak of his fierce opposition to war and global hegemony on the part of the U.S. government. Coleman McCarthy is a former columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is titled, I'd Rather Teach Peace. And he does, at universities and schools throughout the Washington area. McCarthy remembers a man who, in Dr. King, was far more complex than he's been portrayed by some.
I interviewed King when I was a young reporter starting out. He was in Chicago the summer of 66. And that's when he began to talk about a move away from civil rights, not only, but also into the anti-war movement. And he was roundly criticized, particularly by the liberal media, the allegedly liberal media. It really isn't. But they said, what are you doing talking about Vietnam, foreign policy? You don't know about that. You're way over your head. He said, no, I'm not. It's all the same. It's interesting how you rarely hear the media, at least the corporate media, talk about King, the anti-war advocate who said this is the most violent government on earth. And so we're sanitizing King once again. Every year we sanitize a little bit, make him less and less relevant. And when you have George Bush going into a black church and saying, oh, yes, Martin Logue, oh, wonderful, wonderful person, ignoring his anti-war message while he's escalating the war against the Iraqi people, I think it's a disgrace to King's memory.
As a former member of the mainstream media, you were a columnist, of course, for The Washington Post. What are your thoughts in terms of why this sort of thing happens?
Well, it's corporate-owned media. You know, you have a few liberal voices in the media, but the trouble is they can only be as liberal as their conservative editors will let them be. So that's it. You look at the Sunday morning talk shows, Tim Russert, these people, Schieffer, they're all corporate guys. They're wealthy people. How often do you hear on Meet the Press or, you know, Face the Nation and these other programs, anybody from the anti-war be left? Rarely, if ever. So that's okay. The right wing has the media, but the left has the schools. That's where I think it's more important to be, really. Because the corporate media is really show business. Tim Russert, Schieffer, those people, you know, Donahue, Larry King, they're all entertainers. They're not journalists. So when you go to the small press, the Progressive, the Nation, the Mother Jones, National Catholic Reporter, then you get good news that's based on social justice.
Trotsky wrote, to condemn war is easy. To overcome it is difficult.
That's right.
What steps can Americans take to overcome this war in Iraq?
Well, you can. I think you got two choices. You got a short-term solution. Kick up as much dust as you can. Go to protest. Withhold your money from corporations that will profit from this war. Corporate America loves it because they got contracts to sell food, gasoline, equipment, medical supplies. Find out what corporations are going to make money off this war and write to the board chairman of those groups and tell them you're not getting a nickel out of me. And then the long-term solution is to grin the schools. We have 78,000 elementary schools in this country, 28,000 high schools, and 3,100 colleges. All of those, beginning in first grade right through grad school, ought to be teaching the basics of conflict resolution, nonviolence, a resistance. And so you read the literature, and people wake up, wow, there is another way. And so as the great Russian pacifist and anarchist, you might as well do them both, Peter Kropotkin once said, think about the kind of world you want to live in. What do you need to build that world? Demand that your teachers teach you that.
What do you think Martin Luther King Jr. would be saying today? Whenever I pose that question, everyone says it's easy.
He would be saying exactly what he said on April 4th, 67, Riverside Church, New York. Any nation that continues to spend more money on programs of military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual or death. Our military budget, that's what he'd be saying. It's even more true today.
Why I am opposed to the war in Vietnam. Now let me make it clear in the beginning that I see this war as an unjust, evil, and futile war. And I preach to you today on the war in Vietnam because my conscience leaves me with no other choice. The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. In international conflicts, the truth is hard to come by because most nations are deceived about themselves. Rationalizations and the incessant search for scapegoats are the psychological cataracts that blind us to our sins. But the day has passed for superficial patriotism. I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Yes, we must stand and we must speak. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my past. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. And I come this morning to my pulpit to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. This sermon is not addressed to Hanoi or to the National Liberation Front. It is not addressed to China or to Russia, but rather to my fellow Americans who bear the greatest responsibility in ending a conflict that has exacted a heavy price on both continents. Now, since I am a preacher by calling, I suppose it is not surprising that I have 7 major reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, and new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. You may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society, sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. And I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness. For it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers, as I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men. I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. There's been a lot of applauding over the last few years. They've applauded our total movement. They've applauded me. They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. They praised us in Albany and Birmingham. And Selma, Alabama. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause, and so noble in its praise when I was saying, be nonviolent toward Bull Connor. When I was saying, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark. There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark, but will curse and damn you when you say, be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children. There's something wrong with that press. As if the weight of such a commitment to the life and health of America were not enough, another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission. Commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? And finally, I must be true to my conviction that I share with all men the calling to be a son of the living God. Beyond the calling of race, a nation, a creed, is this vocation of sonship and brotherhood. And because I believe that the Father is deeply concerned, especially for his suffering and helpless and outcast children, I come today to speak for them.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam, delivered at the Riverside Church in New York on April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.